The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. First, for those of you who are not part of this class, this is the final class day of the advanced seminar on intellectual property, human rights, and development. And so if you're a 2L, you should think about taking it next year, or a 1L for that matter. So today we're gonna finish off our class with a lecture by James Love and some of his particular thinking on alternatives to the current research and development paradigm. Before we kick into that and before I get into the formal introduction, let me just give a couple class announcements since this is the last day of the class. So first, thank you all. It's been a great class for me. I've learned a lot. It's the first time I think you all know that I've taught this course, and I think it's been extremely successful. Thank you also for your comments on how we might improve it for next year. I posted some things on our Blackboard course list on ideas that I have about how to do that, but I thought it's been extremely successful for me. I've learned a lot. They say that you learn the most from teaching, and I think that's been true here. I've learned more than in any of the classes I actually took when I was in law school. Couple quick notes on the papers. So my understanding is that you can post the papers directly to the Blackboard site. But Maria, you were if you are turning it in for the third year paper, there may be a differentiation. Did you find out more on that?
It's that form that you need to sign. Okay. I need to sign, so I was going to give it to the registrar so that you would be able to get it.
Great. So if you want one of your options is to turn in your paper for your final writing credit, or whatever it's called here, to get your credit for your writing requirement for the graduation. So you can do that, but you need to get me to sign a form for that. So if you're planning on using this as your writing course, please pick up the form from the registrar and bring it to me, and I will gladly sign off on that. And you can still turn it in to me. Okay, so you can still post it to the Blackboard site for that. So the due date is April 30th, which is first day of finals, by 9 in the morning, or you can turn it in, you know, that night, on Sunday night. Just post it to the Blackboard site. And I think that's it on that. Are there any questions on the paper stuff?
The Blackboard says 10 o'clock.
Does it say 10 o'clock?
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever that says is fine. If it says 10 o'clock, that's okay. Not to withdraw an hour from you. I don't know if I've announced this class before, so I will be hiring a PGIP fellow or two, and if you're interested, please see me directly after class. So they're part-time research positions over the summer, about 20 hours. And if you're not engaged over the summer and you're interested in that, please see me directly after this class, because I'll be submitting my my request to the dean for that. And I think that's it for class announcements. Oh, finally, I put I'd like to be able to submit your papers, possibly all of them, maybe selections of them, and post them to our PGIP webpage under our IP Development and Human Rights course. And so if you're willing to do that, I've written a model copyright statement on the announcement for today, just saying that you reserve all rights, but you give PGIP rights to use it for educational non-commercial purposes. So if you're willing to do that, just include that statement in the little footnote by your author name, and that should be sufficient to give us permission to post. You can also, if you'd rather have a discussion about that, then just leave your email, and I can formally request it from you, and you can withhold any rights that you would like. So that said, let's get on to the topic of the day. So as I said, to some extent, you know, the intention of this day is to kind of come full circle. So we started this class with discussions of access to medicine's pieces, and particularly with an overall a movie that we saw, Pills, Profits, and Protests, that has an overall kind of critique of the topic, and includes within it actually many quotes by James Love himself, and ideas for how to restructure the system, which is going to be the final topic of the day. So James Love gave me my start in this topic, so I worked with him I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago now, I suppose.
2002, 2003,
and started as many of you, as a person very interested in human rights, having no real knowledge of intellectual property and how it relates to systems for essential goods and services distribution. And it would not be overstating it to say that James Love taught me pretty much everything I know in that area, and continues to be a very important mentor for me in this area, along with Rob Wiseman, who you've also met. So it's a privilege for me personally to have him here today and to talk about some of the most exciting things that he's thinking about this moment. So over to you.
Thank you, Sean. Can you hear me okay? I'm glad Sean and I work together. With Michael too, and Rob. I think that the biggest thing we did together was the South African competition case, the unpublished South Africa competition case. But what I want to talk to you about today is I assume that in this course, what is the topic of this course? It's, I mean, the, what's it? Okay, so I assume in the course, in this course, that you've discussed many of the issues about the conflicts between, for example, access to medicine on the one hand, and then the intellectual property right system on the other. Particularly when the intellectual property rights system is implemented as a system of monopolies on drugs, and when the person who gets that monopoly charges high prices. So I think it's always been the case, in the area of medicines at least, that when there's a dispute about access to medicine and some reform that's brought about, such as price controls on medicine, or weaker intellectual property system, or making it easier for generic companies to cut through some of the regulatory barriers to entry to compete, such as generic drug approvals, or more recently, people talking about biogenerics. Then in all of these cases, the argument against measures, or like I said, parallel trade is another one, the argument against measures that would make prices more affordable is almost always the argument that if you do that, you'll have less innovation. And so I think if you start with the real reason why do you have an intellectual property system on medicine, it's not because policymakers hate patients or they don't like poor people. It's because there's a widely held assumption, often not really criticized or sort of contested, that it is necessary to create monopolies on drugs for some period of time as a stimulation for people to invest in R&D, and then if you don't do that, you just won't have a pipeline. You won't have anything to argue about having access to. So people tend to accept, I think, fairly high levels of inequality of access to medicine, because they believe it's just sort of an unfortunate but necessary step that you have to undertake to have new medicine. So what I'm talking about today is a challenge to that paradigm that is now, I think, has now more of a critique or a support for in different quarters. And so the name of the talk is A New Paradigm for R&D. And I'm going to start with just a definition of push and pull. Have people here ever heard these expressions ever relate to drug development? I think the idea is if you want to have people to invest in R&D a drug, you can think of different stages that are important for drug development. You have periods when people are established in what is the basic biomedical science. You have people creating databases and libraries, for example, of materials. Then you have journals that are published. You have conferences, meetings. You have people doing experiments in the laboratory on petri dishes and things. You have screening of libraries. You have animal studies, human use clinical trials, and this whole wide range of things to the point where they actually have to try and register a product in the market. And it's pretty hard. And you can tell it's pretty hard because companies that have a lot of money are often very bad at it, despite the fact that they throw a lot of money at it. So I think it's quite famous now that big companies like Pfizer and AstraZeneca and other companies have had rather weak pipelines despite huge budgets in research and development. So and the number of new drugs that are put in the market is not really an impressive number, given the amount of money that's spent. There's probably anywhere from 25 to 35 new chemical entities introduced to the market in any given year. But getting a little bit ahead of myself, but the idea, I think, is that a push funding would be the kind of things that governments do that are more upfront on funding the research. So you might give the National Institutes of Health may give out a grant to somebody to do research. They may fund databases. They may do that. Do things that lower the cost of companies, like have tax credits if they do clinical trials. So you may not know whether clinical trials may be successful or not successful, but you may give them a tax credit for doing it, with the hope that the lowered cost of doing the clinical trial will encourage people to do more of that kind of work. There's a group of product development partnerships things like the Global TB Alliance, or the TB, the TB Alliance, whatever it's called, the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Incorporated, One World Health, FIND. I mean, there's dozens and dozens of these nonprofit organizations that have been created in the last couple of years also to research. And they get funding. And so there's a lot of money that's put before a project is actually successful. And then pull incentives are things where you only give money if the product is actually works. So to be more concrete about it, if you get a patent on a product, the patent itself is not, it's not a reward that's worth much by itself. It's a reward because it gives you the opportunity to have a monopoly on something. So people will invest millions of dollars with the idea that if they come up with something that might be a good product, they'll have a monopoly and they can charge a high price for some period of time. So in that particular case, the money doesn't come until after the product is actually developed into a commercial product and then people begin to buy it. So the pull incentives are things that they come after the fact, after you actually developed a product. And most of what people describe of pull incentives typically are things that give you monopolies or set of exclusive rights, like a patent or a data rights monopoly, or an agreement by the government to buy products at a high price, like advanced purchasing commitment or advanced marketing commitment. There's some proposals that if you want people to do work on river blindness or something, you give them an extension of a patent that's for a heart disease drug so that you kind of allow them to make monopoly profits for a longer period of time for the heart disease drug, which has a big market, in order for developing drugs for something like river blindness, which has a small market. And then that's sort of a pharmaceutical company proposal, big pharmaceutical company proposal. And then prizes, which is an issue I'm going to talk about, which is different ways you can think about rewarding someone who developed a drug, not through the price of the drug, but through a reward that you give for the product based upon, in some formulations, the impact of the invention on healthcare outcomes. So the old paradigm, the primary pull incentives are these marketing monopolies. And the global instruments to make sure that everybody pays for R&D are things that essentially force everybody to have lots of patents and other types of intellectual property, or to have high drug prices. So you observe things like the TRIPS agreement at the WTO, which I assume you're all familiar with if you've taken this course. US-EU bilateral regional IPR agreements, which I'm sure you've heard lots of. Or this new group of agreements which deal with drug prices, so that you have the U.S. and EU agreements with Korea, the EU actions against Turkey, the United States trade agreement with Australia, and discussions with Germany about the reimbursement policies. So All of these things are designed essentially to make sure that if a company is successful in R&D, they can charge high prices everywhere. And that's the paradigm we're trying to escape from. Now, the new paradigm would be that prizes would replace the marketing monopolies as the primary pull incentive, and that you'd have an R&D agreement or treaty to address the free rider issues. So you'd sort of, instead of having agreements on IPR, you'd have agreements on R&D. And instead of having high prices being the pull mechanism, you'd have prizes being the pull mechanism. Those are sort of the two ideas in the new paradigm. Now, within this paradigm, to give you some context and background, there's an extensive academic literature on the use of prizes. And a lot of it comes out of the economics literature about prizes. And I think it causes some confusion sometimes, because if you talk to most people about prizes, they're thinking about, well, you know, they got ribbons maybe when they were a young person for coming in first, you know, or second or third, or they think of the Nobel Peace Prize, or, you know, they think of prizes, these sort of prizes often that are reputational prizes or races, like who's first. And the economics literature, on the other hand, tends to describe prizes as a competitor to patent enforced monopolies, is a alternative economic incentive for doing things. And so I'm talking more about the economics definition of prizes than like a middle school definition of prizes or something like that. Now, and there's a long literature about prizes, and there's a long debate in historical terms about the use of prizes versus other systems. And countries have gone completely off the patent system for a period and experiment with prizes. There's been debates in the French Academy about the relationship between prizes and direct grants or things. But this is, of course, a more modern discussion. So I'll start the history with September 2002. Aventis, which is now Aventis Sanofi Aventis, did I say that right? It's the French company, was then one of the big pharma companies. And they had a German CEO, and the German CEO was quite interested in this access to medicines debate, and he had subscribed to IP Health, our listserv, about these issues, and was following these discussions on the listserv. And he had also followed the human genome debate about whether the human genome was in the public domain or not, and he thought there was things happening that were a challenge to strong intellectual property rights. And so he was trying to do some thinking about what his company's business challenges would look like if our side won and his side lost. So they invited Tim Hubbard, who's head of human genome research for the Wellcome Trust and one of the main advocates of making the Human Genome Project in the public domain, and myself, to a meeting in September of in France with 25 of his executives from the company to do a three-day scenario planning as what would happen if we won and they lost, basically. And out of that, we came up with a proposal that would involve this new paradigm that we're promoting, which is that you have as an international treaty format no longer agreements about IPR, but you have agreements on what fraction of the GDP countries are willing to do to support R&D, and that you allow countries in the context of this treaty framework to choose any different mechanism you'd like as far as funding R&D, that you could choose all open source funding, all public domain databases, you could use patents with high prices with trickle-down R&D incentives, or you could have prizes, you could do whatever you wanted to do. It was kind of the global anti-free rider format, but then we also modeled the idea of what would happen if the U.S. completely eliminated patent monopolies for drugs in the United States and move to nothing but generic production, and what kind of a price system you can implement in the U.S. would bring the U.S. prices from the highest in the world down to the lowest in the world, what that would look like. And the executives at Aventis were a bit uneasy with the scenario because they recognized that we were breaking the market into three categories. We had the idea that you had the people that did research and development on products, you had the people that manufactured and sold products through stores and did the distribution. We call that the generic sector and in our model. And then you had a category of people that gave information to doctors about which product to use. We call that the marketing sector. And the companies understood that we were moving production to the generic sector. We were creating a set of rich rewards for the innovators, the guys that do the R&D, but that we were really cutting back the amount of money that was going to go to the marketing end of business. And we said to them, well, you should be okay about this because the marketing operation is actually expensive for you. You know, you save money if you don't have to do so much, invest so much in the, you know, the competition you have with other drug companies to win over the favors of doctors and things. And they said, well, not everything we do with the medical doctors is useless. wasn't a strong defense of that line of business, but they did say there's some useful information that goes out there. But we said, look, you must be good at R&D. That's why you're a big pharma, right? I mean, you must be better at it than small companies. That's how you got to be big, right? You must have a competitive advantage in R&D. And they said, well, actually, if you look at our company, all our growth has come through acquisition. They said our internal pipeline's not very good. And I think that's actually a story for most big pharma companies, is that their growth comes through acquisition of technology from smaller firms, and their internal pipeline's not very good. And the one thing they were really good at was that marketing activity that we were going to get rid of, actually. That turned out to be, in fact, where the majority of their workforce was employed. Remember, we asked them how many employees you had, and they said 76,000. And we said, how many work in R&D? And they said, 7,000. And we said, well, what do the other 69,000 people do? And they said, they sell the drugs. And so you can kind of understand, you know, that their reaction to our proposal was not very favorable, I'd have to say. But that's how we like this. And so Tim and I began to, and other people like this proposal, we began to then present the idea of the new paradigm in a variety of workshops throughout the world. We were invited to do workshops in Bellagio and give papers in South Africa and Penang and all over the planet. And there was another idea about competitive intermediaries, which is really, I think, an interesting way to think about funding open source technology as a competitive model for it. But I'm not going to get into it today unless we get into it in Q&A because I don't have much time. So I'm sticking to the main ideas here. The main idea is you want to separate the market for innovation from the market for the product. Now, how many of you here are in favor of access to drugs? And how many people here are in favor of innovation? So do you want to choose between one or the other? That's really a tough one, right? You don't really want to have to decide one or the other, right? You want both, right? So the idea of separating the market for innovation, market for the product, is to say, let's just make access part of the deal, that you have to give access, that everybody gets access to drugs for the copy of, you know, the cost of making a copy. I heard Ben the other day describing this issue about intellectual property, that if you have a bicycle and somebody takes your bicycle, you don't have your bicycle anymore and you're a sad person. But if somebody takes a photograph of your bicycle, you don't, and makes then you don't really, I mean, it's not like you're out much, right? You may have lost some spiritual unity or something, but you're essentially still have your bicycle. So with drug development, there's an invention, and it may be very cheap to make copies of the invention. So somebody has to make, you know, pay for the cost of building the first bicycle, I guess, and figure out some way to value it. But you want to permit people to make copies of the product in such a way that people who can afford it at a lower price, if that's still higher than the cost of making a copy, can have access. So we want to have a market for innovation, but we don't want it tied to the price. So that's the big idea. So what's the consequence of the current system of exclusive marketing rights on R&D access? Well, let's start with this example from 2004 in South Africa. This is something that Sean and I worked on back then. But Singular is an asthma drug that my son takes. So I've been interested in this accessibility of this product. It's a pill you take once a day that means you have fewer asthma attacks, and at least for my son anyhow, it's been a significant improvement in the quality of his life. And I think it's easy. It's good for a lot of adolescent pages, but adults also use it because they may have trouble managing these incredibly complicated breathing delivery systems you have for products and things. In any event, this is a map of the price of the drug in 10 different income deciles. That means, by decile, means like the top 10%, and then the 80 to 90%, the 70 to 80%. Each decile is a 10% of the population. They're ranked by income. Number one is the richest people. And this takes the price of this drug, which you have to take every day, and it divides it by the average income for the people in that decile. And so it's about 4% of the average income of the top decile. So based on the research that Sean and I did in the South Africa case with Michael, I think that it's probably the only group in South Africa that was expected to buy this drug was probably the people in the top income decile. I mean, because people are just not going to spend more than 4% of their incomes to buy a drug you have to take every day, all the time. And so people would say, well, Merck must be crazy. Why does Merck price a drug so only 1 out of 10 people in South Africa can afford it? Doesn't Merck want to make much bigger profits, for example, by selling it to the top 20%? Why do the top? They could sell twice as many units if you lower the price, so that the next 20%. Well, it turns out that in South Africa, that the top 10% have half the income of the whole country. So to lower the price enough so the next 10% can afford the drug, your total revenue are going to fall. You completely lose money if you drop the price to the next 10 people. It can happen. Now, I'll just give you some other examples. Pfizer, someone who worked for Pfizer was recently telling me that he did a study when he was working for Pfizer as to countries that make income between $2,000 and $9,000 a year. And they wanted to know, if Pfizer lowered their drug prices, what would happen to utilization? And they said that there would be a five-fold increase in utilization of the products, which is a big increase. But he said the bad news is that their profits would fall if they did that. So they didn't do it. So it's not like companies don't think about these things. They actually think quite a bit about them, and they model them quite intensively. But just they understand that the profit maximizing price may not be the price that maximizes the social benefits of the product. And that's just because countries are not only different income from each other, like South Africa not only has a different income from the United States and a different income from Uganda, but there's people within those countries that have different incomes from each other. So a typical developing country scenario is that companies charge prices that only the elites can afford. Now, I don't think people would tolerate prices of some products, like certain cancer drugs or AIDS drugs, if, for example, in the United States, only 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10 AIDS patient can afford AIDS drugs. I just don't think that would work politically in the United States or in Europe. Although, on the other hand, for a drug like Singular, I know that my own insurance company was reluctant to pay for it for quite a while at the high U.S. price. And there are some countries that just didn't pay for it on the state insurance company. So you do see some rationing even in high-income countries, but I think that the rationing problem is much more severe in developing countries. These are the prices that Sanofi and BMS were charging for this heart disease drug, Plavix. In the United States, they were charging $4.20 a day for this product. It was $2 a day in Thailand. It was a price that the health ministry said was unaffordable for 80% of the Thai population. And when Bristol-Myers, when the compulsory license was issued in this product, they were able to buy it initially for around 17 cents a day. And I think that price would fall as it stimulate competition. So, these are the kind of decisions that countries look at. In 2004, Nirvana famously said at the World Bank, we consider India to be a market of 50 million people. That's 5% of the population. I think they've expanded that number to 100 million or something lately. But it's just an implicit agreement that they would have this severe rationing. And then this is sort of the U.S. version where Dr. Wittes, who used to work for Bristol-Myers Squibb and for the National Cancer Institute, and I think he's at the Sloan Kettering Center now. He was talking about the high prices for cancer drugs are so expensive that insurance companies try and find all kinds of way to afford paying for them and discourage people from having access. In some cases, we'll just say no. So essentially, you observe more and more difficult access for high-priced drugs. So what do the economics of the current system look like? Well, according to the firm IMS, which appears to have a monopoly practically on any information about pharmaceutical sales internationally, you'd think the governments would get together and create their own databases so they wouldn't have to have all this lack of information. But anyway, from IMS, they say 2005 there was $602 billion spent on pharmaceuticals, which is about 1.35% of global GDP. And in that same year, the IFPMA, which is the big global drug manufacturers association, they claim that private sector investments for R&D were around $51 billion, or less than 9% of global sales. So that's basically right now you get globally around 9% of global purchases are being spent on R&D. Now, some experts believe the current system of marketing monopolies for drug increased 2006 drug prices by somewhere between $400 and $500 billion a year. So right now, the way you pay for that $51 billion in medical R&D is you pay about $400 or $500 billion a year in higher prices. So that's something to think about. The reason why prices were $600 billion instead of say $200 billion or $100 billion in 2006 is because of the patent system. So the difference between what generic prices would be and what they are with the patent system is what you pay to get these people to do that $51 billion in investment. That's the way we do it. So what do they invest their money in? Well, according to the US FDA, over a period of 15 years, 22.5% of new drug approvals during that period were for products that had significant improvements compared to marketed products that were already on the market. And then and only 14.3% of total were new molecular entities that were classified as priority products. And so so a fair amount of products which are registered by the FDA are products that the FDA itself says do not have significant improvements compared to existing products. Those are the so-called Me Too drug registrations that people talk about. And there's a reason for that. I mean, if people are willing to pay $4 a day for Plavix, and you could come along with a drug that's about the same as Plavix, you probably reckon you could probably get about $4 a day too if you put really good TV ads on, on television, or, bought a lot of pizzas for doctors or whatever the heck they do. I mean, so there's an incentive. The science is actually easier because you already know how Plavix works. You know how much people are willing to pay for it. So it's actually less risky for a company to develop a knockoff of Plavix than it is to try and do something where the science is completely unknown. So you get a lot of investment in existing products. And sometimes it's, I'm not saying there's no benefits from these products, but some people question whether or not that's where the money should be going to the degree it does. So there's also very little investment in products that serve poor populations. So you have the WHO classifies type 2 diseases as things like AIDS, tuberculosis, and to some extent malaria, where there's some market form in higher income customers and higher income people, but not as much as would be reflected by the incidence of disease. You may have 2 million people with AIDS in high-income countries and 38 million people living in developing countries, for example, with AIDS. And then not enough maybe designing products so they can work in resource-poor settings, like a lack of insulin, for example, that's heat-stabilized for people without refrigeration. You maybe have poor incentives to develop products that are used as a last resort or only in emergencies. This is a problem in the antibiotic market. I mean, like if the antibiotics, if you think about them, the ideal use of an antibiotic is not to give it to a patient unless the other antibiotics they would take don't work. I mean, you try and treat them with a regime which is an older regime, and every time somebody takes an antibiotic, they essentially develop more resistance for that product, and there's sort of a negative externality on the whole world. And so you know, you're asking somebody to develop a new antibiotic and then make sure nobody gets it. It's sort of a weird business model for a company. And then, you know, when you would need it is kind of probably when the patent protection starts to wear off, you know, or when you want to have widespread use of it. Or stockpiling, like Tamiflu for bird flu or something like that. You may want products or a vaccine for bird flu or something. You may want products that have a low probability of ever being used, but you may want to have them in the medicine cabinet in case you need them. And then there's excessive investments in R&D that have little scientific value or limited medical importance. This is some data that Michael and Julie Patel worked on with us. This is just global burden of disease by cause and level of development. The green is communicable diseases. The purple is non-communicable diseases. And the red is injury. Now, communicable means something that you can get from another person. So AIDS would be a communicable disease. The flu would be a communicable disease. A non-communicable disease would be something like diabetes or cancer. Well, actually, some forms of cancer are communicable, like cervical cancer is caused by a communicable virus. But then lung cancer, for example, you know, from smoking or something would be considered the other. And if you look at I won't dwell here too much, but the disease burden as measured by non-communicable disease, the purple line, is roughly the same everywhere between the world and high-income countries, which are developed, and then you have these two categories of developing countries, low mortality and high mortality. There's not much difference in the incidence of, say, cancer, diabetes, asthma, things like that, heart disease. The communicable diseases are really special in the sense that they're kind of under control as far as deaths are concerned in developing countries, but they're completely out of control at the very bottom. And so some people one minor message here, some people say that the needs of the poor are that they need more research on products to deal with their issues of communicable diseases. And that's true, but it's also true that they need access to the non-communicable diseases because the burden is roughly the same as it is in the north as well. So they need access to everything, but probably more R&D in this other category. Now, these are some bits on marketing here. It's expensive. So I think I discussed this before. You probably have the clinical trials, by the way, on the Me Too drugs are about twice as big as the clinical trials on the more important medical drugs. So you probably have about $600 billion market, probably about $51 billion goes into R&D, and you're probably about $15 billion of the $51 billion that is really important R&D, which is to say does not involve clinical trials, which are essentially marketing trials that have little scientific basis. Only about half the clinical trials that are done on products are even put on the FDA label, because they're considered scientifically important. And the clinical trials are smaller for the more important products. So here's the radical reform approach, the prize approach. Our proposal is initially to leave the patent system intact through product development and marketing approval, but then to have no market exclusivity once a product is developed and allow generics to compete against each other, and to reward inventions of new products through this idea of prizes. And this was a proposal in 2005. We're hoping that it'll be reintroduced soon, maybe with a different configuration. But the initial thing would set aside 0.5% of the GDP of the United States government, or the United States economy, rather, or then about $60 billion a year, into a set of prizes. The way you get the prizes is you put a product on the market. Suppose you put a heart disease drug or a cancer drug or an AIDS drug in the market, then there'd be a 10-year period where once a year you'd get a payday. And the way it would work is every year you'd submit evidence of the medical benefits of your product, which went beyond what was already, you know, available to society. In other words, what did your drug get you that other products had not really delivered? And everyone that you're competed against would do exactly the same thing. So if we all had our own drug companies, we'd all submit evidence of what, say, our quality-adjusted life years or disability-adjusted life years would be. And then we'd sort of add up the total and kind of divide it among each other based upon our contribution. That's sort of the simple version of the mechanism. There's actually, I think, you can kind of improve on that, but that's sort of a good way to begin thinking about it. And so as a drug developer, you would say to yourself, if I develop a drug, I reckon it'll have these kind of healthcare benefits based on the impact it'll have in the U.S. market. And so I will then, I can see that, you know, a quality adjusted life year seems to be paying X based on, you know, how the market looks so far. And then you sort of do the math. You figure out whether or not it's worth your while to invest or not. And if you want more investment in R&D, you just have to raise the total fund. So the actual end of this model, the amount of money that every innovator gets paid is determined by the market. The government sets a fixed fund. Firms compete against each other for slices of the fund. And the valuation of quality is done by the supply and demand. The demand is set by the size of the fund and the supply is by the private sector. So it's actually a market-driven valuation of the outcomes. And it's transparent in the sense that you're willing to pay for outcomes. There has to be, and you have a 10-year period of evaluation, so you don't even have to know very much on the first year the product's on the market. You're willing to kind of, and you can do it longer than 10-year. If you could make it a 15-year period if you want. But the thing is, it's you compete against other people. In the U.S. proposal, there were some set-asides for some priority projects, such as global neglected diseases, orphan drugs, or research for public health priorities, such as new antibiotics or bioterrorism or things like that. And these, of course, can be instruments of policy. I mean, the idea was, even in the bill, these were initial allocations, but the fund was allowed to change this over time in order to respond to public interest in having additional research in particular areas. So you could say that even though the fund in total is 60, you know, is a certain fraction of GDP, that you want to sort of move money, more money into AIDS research or more money into different areas if you thought that was important. There's some different approaches people have taken. Thomas Pogge, a political scientist, in 2005 proposed a system where the government's just announced they will pay. This is a voluntary system where the companies announced they would just pay so much per quality. The problem we perceived with his proposal was that it was a relatively open-ended commitment, and we thought that a lot of governments might feel uncomfortable about the open-ended commitment. And it also meant, from the point of view of the government, that every time somebody benefited from your product, it caused a financial obligation on the country itself. So the countries would have an incentive to restrict access under that circumstance, because it would, you know, access would result in a liability. Every time somebody benefited, you had to pay. So we like the idea of you just agree upon how much you're going to pay, and once you make that agreement, your liability doesn't change. That way it's truly free on the margin, where the Pogge thing, it's never free on the margin in terms of the way the government looks at. And then the Hollis proposal is very much our approach. I probably have to modify the slide because he's written me recently to he wants a little nuanced explanation. But Aidan Hollis had submitted some papers to different people, including the WHO, and his everybody works in different circles. So Thomas has been zipping around the planet presenting his paper. Aidan sort of moved in a different set of circles, and then Jill Stiglitz does and others. And so there's now a proliferation. Actually, there's some other, there's in our paper that Sean has distributed, right, at this class. So I give actually a lot of other people that have written about these things, including a very nice op-ed in the Washington Post in 2003, which was quite good, by Burton Weisbread, which I thought was a nice op-ed version of this discussion. Now, this basically goes a little bit to the global R&D aspect of things, because if you want to get rid of the TRIPS agreement, if you want to get rid of the IPR chapters in these FDA agreements, you need to sort of, in our opinion, answer the question as to who's going to pay the R&D and have more people in the answer to that question than just American consumers and taxpayers. And so this is basically an idea of how you globalize the issue of who pays, and also how you address other issues such as technology transfer or priority setting for research priorities. And so the idea is you create a treaty secretary of a country. They can purchase drugs and pay higher prices, and then you kind of look at maybe what fraction of the purchases are reinvested in new drugs. Or they could use a prize fund, and you can figure out how much money they put in the prize fund and how much R&D that is stimulating. You have research grants like the NIH gives out. You could actually fund projects like the Medicines for Malaria venture or Drugs for Neglected Disease. You could invest in another country's project in some collaborative project, maybe working with Kenya on some public health problem or Thailand. You report what you did to the Treaty Secretariat. They'd have an infrastructure over them. And what you'd be trying to measure in this format is whether or not collectively you met your obligations. So if your obligation was that you had to fund 15 basis points of GDP or 20 basis, whatever the number might be of your overall GNP, you're supposed to be financing in terms of R&D, you'd have to show not that you used a particular mechanism, but that some combination of a lot of different mechanisms added up to what your obligation was. So you actually have flexibility in terms of what you did, but no flexibility on doing something versus doing nothing. So you had to pay, but you got to choose. And in fact, you could choose, a lot of countries may prefer this because they could invest in medical problems that are more relevant to their own populations, or they could build up the capacity of their own businesses or their own universities and things like that. So you might see a more decentralized system of doing medical research. Now, there was also the idea that you might actually think about other things you might throw into the treaty. You might want to identify priority research projects. And there was a quite elaborate system in 2005 that was proposed to create a set of tradable credits for priority research, or not just partly priority research, but also some other obligations. So that suppose you really felt that every country should have to fund part of the research budget into priority projects. And the idea was, and also you'd give some credits for doing this, so that a dollar spent on, say, malaria research that was open source would be rewarded more than a dollar on closed research for heart disease, to which you already had a lot of research in. And so in that situation, you create an economic incentive for a country to put more of its money into open source malaria research, because that was being given a bonus, a credit, just like a tax credit would in the U.S. code. And that if you were under your numbers in terms of having done research, you'd also have the option of, if some other country was above its numbers, like if Kenya had done more than it was obligated to, because its Kenya obligation was low to start with, Kenya could then sell its credits to a country like Sweden, which maybe had a high burden because it was a high-income country. So you actually create a global market in these priority projects. And countries would also have incentives to do collaborative projects with developing countries, because that would be considered to be also a thing that would give rise to credit. So you can essentially create a set of through this system of credits. You have, on the one hand, an obligation to do priority research, and then an incentive. You get an extra reward if you do it. And if you go beyond what you needed to make your own numbers, you could then sell your credits to a third party that was under their numbers. And so the idea is you could essentially create this global market for public goods. You could also, there were certain provisions that dealt with issues. One of the credits was for documenting and disseminating and making more accessible traditional knowledge for medical purposes. And then there was other things on open access publishing. I won't go through everything here. So then what are the sort of short-term opportunities here? Well, the WHO has created an intergovernmental working group called the IGWG, or by the insiders in the process, the IGWG, because nobody can remember IGWG very well. So IGWG has become the way to describe the WHO thing. And what is the IGWG? Well, it turns out WHO has had lots of IGWGs. It's an intergovernmental working group. That is what was created when the Tobacco Convention, the Tobacco Control Treaty, was done. It's basically a negotiation among member states. So it's exactly what we were asking for, to think about moving ahead in these things. And in May last year, to the surprise of quite a few people, the WHO created this IGWIG, and they gave it a very fast-track process to be finished by May of 2008. That's next year, a year from now, discussions on these various things. And so we had thought this is the beginning of a negotiation on this new paradigm, on moving toward this R&D treaty framework instead of the IPR framework, and experimenting with things like prizes instead of prices to stimulate R&D, but also, you know, these multilateral incentives to invest in public goods like public databases and open source research and things like that. And there are now a number of country papers in this process that address everything I've described here, and other things I haven't had time to describe, like patent pools, for example, to enhance access to medicines and things. What are realistic goals for the IGWIG process? Soft norms or voluntary fund for R&D on type 2 and type 3 diseases. I think that's probably a fairly manageable objective in this. It's possible we could get support for patent pool for licensing of patents on medical technologies, or this is more controversial, speaking in terms of the actual negotiations right now. And possible agreement to introduce prize mechanisms, both to reward people who do research on neglected disease and also possibly as an incentive to licensure patents for broader access. These are some of the things that are being discussed right now. How many people here have advanced purchase funds or advanced marketing commitments? Have you spent much time here? I won't spend much time in this except to say that there's sort of a competing idea that Bill Gates has been pushing, and because Bill Gates is pushing, it's attracted a lot of attention among governments as well as other people to stimulate R&D in neglected diseases through agreeing to buy really high prices for the product for some period of time, or fairly high prices. The theory being that the R&D system would work perfect if poor people just had as much money as rich people. And so under this sort of system, you give almost like food stamps, but you give the equivalent of R&D stamps to poor people, but they can only buy it on products that you specify. Well, I won't go into the details, but there's actually U.S. has not signed on to this in the international arena, although they have a version of this for a BioShield program, which is controversial and has not worked very well yet. Key issues in the prizes. These are a bunch of them. I'm not going to drag you through them right now. I think I've already talked too long. There's one additional fora, and this is my last slide I wanted to mention, or two. In the Global Fund, do you know what the Global Fund is? Global Fund for AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis. It's this multilateral forum. Donors put in money to buy drugs for AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis in developing countries. And then UNITAD is a French proposal that's been set up where countries donate like $1 for a regular airplane ticket and $10 for a business class ticket into a fund. And there's now Norway, UK, France, Chile, and Brazil are basically on the board of directors of this thing. And they'll have $500 million next year to spend. And George Bermudez is the new executive director, and he's quite keen on these crazy ideas too, which is good. So, and the new Global Fund guy looks like he's an experimenter too. Also, he's French. George Bermudez is Brazilian. Anyway, so one idea that we've made that we're discussing with people and others are discussing is the idea that what is the Global Fund? The Global Fund is mainly most people think for AIDS, but they also do tuberculosis and malaria. And they spend a lot of money. It's supposed to be a multi-billion-dollar-a-year fund for treatment. Now, right now, they've got people on AIDS being treated for drug regimes they pay $110 to $150 a year for. In Thailand, 2 months ago, Abbott was charging $3,900 for just Caltrate, which is just part of an AIDS cocktail. So if you want to move people from a $150 regime to a $4,000 regime, and you've got 1 million, 2 million, 3 million people on treatment and they need it for the rest of their lives, the math is very difficult. So the high prices on the second line regime totally threatens the sustainability of AIDS treatment in developing countries. So what we have said is right now you have perverse incentives. The people that voluntarily license their patents or forego patenting on AIDS drugs in developing countries get nothing. And people that are really tough guys like Abbott or until recently Merck and things with the Pfizer and they charge high prices, they get a lot of money or Roche or whatever. So what we said is what you need is a different set of incentives where you actually don't reward people for essentially antisocial behavior. The other thing we say is that AIDS treatment, for example, in developing countries is more or less become a European and American taxpayer supported venture. What fraction of AIDS treatment in Africa do you think is paid for by African consumers and African taxpayers? And my answer would be probably less than 1%. I mean, it's a very small number. So the American government and the European governments are beginning to figure out that by charging high prices for AIDS drugs in developing countries, it's their own pocket that's writing the checks. I mean, they thought they were somehow making these huge profits for their companies in Africa until they realized that, hey, that's us, right? You know. And the Global Fund has created a problem because companies that didn't used to patent in Africa now patent in Africa. Like Gilead has two AIDS drugs. The first one, tenofovir, good product, came in the market first, patented nowhere in Africa. The second one, licensed from Emory University, FTC, licensed in 38 African countries, introduced in the market in the U.S. in 2003. Now, they did that because at that point, you could see the Global Fund was going to be a big market. So in a way, the Global Fund's attracting more patents. So the idea is to say that 10% of drug purchases should be set up in a prize fund to reward people on the basis of the impact of their inventions on healthcare outcomes in developing countries. Only if the person who is a drug developer either foregoes patents or licensed the patents on the products to a patent pool to permit generic production of the products. So under that scenario, you create an extra incentive to license patents to the pool. And the first company to license their patents to the pool gets a lot of money because 10% of drug purchases, it turns out to be a fairly large amount of money. And then you say, well, I don't want him to get all the money. I want some of them. And then people start to license. And at a certain point, the government say, look, if you don't license, we're going to issue a compulsory license. This is the deal. We're not going to pay you $4,000 for a second-line AIDS drug. What we will do is we'll give you 10% of our drug purchases, depending on how good your drugs are. And you can argue, should it be 8%, 10%, 12%, 20%? You can have an argument about how much money it goes. But it's nice because if you think about it, there wouldn't be a market for these products in developing countries without the Global Fund or PEPFAR program. And the prize fund is then totally linked to the drug purchases in a way that has the same predictability and credibility that the expectation you get paid prices through the Global Fund. So you basically, it's the way the funders say, and another way to think about it is, why would a government put $1 billion up as a donor for treatment of AIDS unless they thought there'd be a lot of people getting AIDS treatment? The donors will spend more if they can help more people. So at high prices, the donors are going to pull out. At low prices, they'll be sustainable. So it's actually in the company's interest not to have the donors pull out of this market, because then it goes to zero, basically. But the donors don't want to do it if the incremental patient has to have two or three orders of magnitude higher prices than the previous thing. So it's basically an agreement that you have marginal cost pricing in the product, but a steady stream and a predictable stream of money for the innovators based upon the impact of the invention. And we've actually now had some companies saying they think this is the right way to think about treatment for AIDS in developing countries, that it actually makes more sense than the current system. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I think we have 15 minutes or so for questions and discussion. I think one of my first just to pick up on some of the themes of the class, listening to this. So I think this is pretty much a complete shift from, as we've been talking in our class about two schools of legal thought, what we've been calling classical legal thought, the idea of constructing spheres of autonomy and allow people to contract through them. The classical intellectual property legal system falls into that, right? So you construct intellectual property property rights and allow people to contract through them towards your social objectives. And then we talked about the period of the social, which is more like utility regulation paradigm, the idea that you would have some kind of expert body that would oversee the market, if you will, and determine what's in the public interest and use a public interest framework to try to administer a social system. So Jamie's presentation shifts from this, shifts intellectual property from that classical legal thought idea to the social idea, right? It sets up an international utility regulation type framework, not drawing on that model exclusively, but sets up a new public interest body to try to administer the system towards social impacts. And so one of the ideas, I mean, one of the questions is kind of, you know, will that work? How will it work? How will it change the system? Will it be effective towards towards moving towards the public interest? I guess one of the questions I'll just put on the table for Jamie. So one of the critiques of social systems throughout the kind of modern period, especially in utility regulation, has been this idea of capture of the administrative state, right? So that you set up a system in utility regulation, for instance, and over the years, if they only see the perspectives of just the regulated party, and so you have an expert body that primarily looks at submissions from the regulated entity, they tend to be captured by that entity and move towards that regulated industry's interests. And so there have been, you know, responses in the consumer community, citizen utility boards, et cetera, to try to open up the process to more politicization to some point. I wonder if you've thought about any of those kind of questions and how kind of consumers' voices will get in and make sure that there's a balance in the political forces before whatever structure is going to set up to determine it, prices, et cetera, or the price amount.
I think if you look at the current system right now, R&D incentives are linked to prices, and companies lobby a lot on price issues. They lobby against price regulation in the United States. They lobby in the UK and Australia and everywhere else for things that lead to higher prices. I think that under the price fund configuration, where the reward is fixed in any given year. You can change it from year to year, but any given year, the reward for that year is payments is fixed. And the companies are merely dividing the pie up against each other. They're faced with a different problem. What they try and do right under the current system is sort of move the demand curve out by having everybody's product gets a higher price. I mean, for a while, every new AIDS drug was priced higher than the previous AIDS drug. I mean, it was, you know, and you think that's crazy. Like, won't you lose sales if you're higher priced than the other guy? It's almost like a positive signal for the consumer. If you have a $3 drug and a $4 drug, a lot of consumers will think that the $4 drug is better than the $3 drug just because it's priced higher. And as long as the insurance company is paying for it, then that, you know, that seems like the one they want. So they have sort of a perverse set of incentives. Now, if you had no quality signal from the price, that is, it was understood that the price was being rewarded separately by the price mechanism. And if all the drug developers knew that the more I got, the less you got, my submissions then will be critically appraised by you because we're splitting up the same pie. And so the companies themselves would have an interest in transparent and non-corrupt rules in terms of the administration of the fund and fairly predictable and rational basis because unpredictable cheating by third parties and things like that is sort of threatens, I think the system in that way. So we're hoping that that would actually be a positive. Now about patients, as far as patients are concerned, they would, as taxpayers, you know, you have to decide, should the fund be 0.5%, 0.7%, 1%? You know, you have to decide how big the fund would be. And then you kind of looked at what there'd be a tension between the companies wanting to make the fund as a general thing bigger or smaller, but that's actually a good argument to have. I mean, they have to lobby to increase the thing based upon the perceived value that they have for having higher amounts. I personally would be a hawk for a fairly high level of funding. We've tried internally to argue for a bigger fund. We'd like the new bill to start out with $100 billion instead of $60 billion because we just want the number to look bigger for everybody. And we wouldn't mind if somebody came in and the companies came in and said they'd like it to be $150 billion. We think that would be a progress in terms of the dialogue. So, but the political economy should be one where it's in everyone's interest to have more transparency. And it's in everyone's interest to sort of get the metrics right in terms of the payoff scheme. And then also, though, what we're trying to design something where ultimately I think it's probably the case in the prize fund thing that the existence of a small number of firms that control a lot of drugs would probably be, there's reason to think that would change because the predominance right now of like a small number of big pharma companies is probably due to the fact that it's very expensive to maintain big marketing operations. I mean, this, you know, the 70,000 salesmen is a very expensive thing. Not many companies can kind of do that. So, and having a personal relationship and with every doctor on the planet is a very difficult thing for people to do. If you have smaller investments in marketing, if more of the rewards going to people that do the innovative work, and if that turns out to be not a, you know, a relatively risky thing, and you have a large number of companies, you're unlikely to have a small number of companies that are owning all the inventions that are coming to the market, or as big of a percent as it is done right now. So we think it would be manageable. Well, we've been trying to get traction in different areas. We're hoping that a new bill, I've actually meeting in Capitol Hill this afternoon, actually. Maybe I shouldn't say that. I guess it's okay to talk to somebody about this. But we're expecting to see a new bill introduced this year on the prize fund. And the original goal in terms of the U.S. strategy was to see the due diligence done first, to have the people do the technical work. I mean, Ben is here from our shop, Ben Cromwell, and he came over from NIH. He's been working this year this has been one of his main responsibilities, working on this bill. And there's a lot of other people they're debating kind of the technical issues about the prize fund, because a lot of issues people have to discuss and criticism. So he's been organizing brown bag lunches, and we'll be doing more seminars and things just on this topic. Then when we feel that there's enough kind of a written record, enough articles and sort of critical mass of critical policy wonk thinking, then it's interesting to take it to a broader audience through, I mean, Slate has expressed an interest in doing a piece on this, and other types of magazines and news articles are I think will sort of follow from that. But we wanted to start with kind of like get the technical work done first. And I think we're passing through that stage. And then the second part was to sort of get a serious policy wonk discussion, or, you know, op-ed columns to say, oh, isn't that an interesting idea and things like that. And then politically to have you know, if you could get a hearing or two, it would be really fabulous on something like that, to kind of really get people's head around. We think with the internet today, it's much easier to spread ideas and new ideas on something like this than it would have been like 10, 15 years ago. Some people that have gone through discussions in this say one of the things they like about it is that it's a radical change as opposed to a change around the margins. They actually find it more interesting to think about. And so the theory there is that a big change is actually easier than a small change, because you can actually say to people, look, this is what we're thinking about. If we win, you'll have drugs at marginal cost in Des Moines, Iowa, in Seattle, Washington, in New Orleans, everywhere, you know, East Harlem, West Harlem, you know, everywhere you'll get drugs at generic prices. That's what happens to you if we win. And this is why we think it can work. And there are a lot of people that would, you know, it would benefit if you prevail. Employers like Verizon or General Motors, governors that have to pay for medicines, consumers, you know, people that face chronic illnesses or things like that, that are I think potential supporters for something like this. And it would be this, like, you know, big change. So the question is, could you sort of catch a wave on this? Could people actually discuss it? We think things go very well for us when you get people to actually do the number crunching and you work through the actual scenarios. I think it's almost like an obvious idea. In fact, people that do any serious work at this look like it's so obvious that you should switch from the current system, which is very expensive and highly dysfunctional, to the new system. But usually the argument is a political argument. It's just, say, people as conservative, they say, well, why should I invest any attention on this? Because drug companies are too powerful and, you know, things never change. And how do you get them to go along with it? And, well, you don't always have to get, you know, the other people voluntarily to go along with things. Like AT&T would have loved to have been a monopoly for the rest of eternity, but that just isn't happening. And if you look at the development of the internet, it was sort of a completely radical change in the business model. The idea that you'd have a network that everybody owned their piece of it, things like web page surfing and email would be free in the margin. People would have thought you were absolutely insane if you would have described the internet, you know, 15 years ago to most people. But having gone through the experience where people saw that your internet developed, now people's expectation are that for knowledge goods, you can actually do things that are quite different. I mean, they actually believe that business models can change because they've seen telecommunications market, internet, they've seen things actually change quite a bit. So I think expectations that outside the beltway are that you can do radical things. And are the drug companies invincible? Well, actually, no. I mean, there were 70 votes last year on parallel trade in the U.S. Senate. Half the Republicans and all the Democrats voted against Big Pharma on a very important issue for them, which is parallel trade with Canada and Europe. So I think that where you have a hard time with Big Pharma companies, if it's a very technical issue that nobody understands, but if the issue is like big enough and simple enough that people can do it, you can do better. Another thing, though, that I would say is that there's a completely separate effort to market this as a solution in developing countries or for public health problems like research on these so-called type 2, type 3 diseases. And in fact, if anything, it's moving faster outside the United States than it is in the United States right now. And you're actually beginning to see some drug companies actually take a second look at the process, not through the lens of us radically transforming the U.S. market, but as a more sustainable market for them to think about getting a payday for things they do that are relevant to developing countries, particularly in this area of so-called type 2, type 3 diseases. So we've actually seen a softening of the position on industries in the international negotiations, which has, I think, been surprising to a lot of people. I mean, because we started out so provocatively looking at the U.S. market, which is huge. And so there's sort of different schools of thought. Some people say you start with developing country markets, you test it out with AIDS drugs or with river blindness and things like that, and you sort of see how it works out. And other people have said, no, you start out with the U.S. I think our strategy is to really is push it everywhere. In fact, one recent thing is the European Commission has asked us to model the prize fund for Europe because within Europe, they have very big differences of income with the accession states. And you have several states in Europe that have lower incomes than African countries have. In a place where you have Sweden and Denmark, and there's just huge differences within Europe in terms of per capita income. So the prize fund is actually an appealing solution to the European problem because they can manage the affordability, they can stimulate innovation, and at the same time, they can manage the situation where you go from $3,000 to $60,000 per capita income in a market where they want to have uniform prices. So in kind of unexpected places, we're beginning to see some traction. Yes. So the metrics people, it's funny because to me, people normally think of different metrics for developing countries than developed countries, and I find it kind of a sad comment on how people think about the expectations of healthcare in developing countries, but usually they think of disability-adjusted life years in developing countries, which relate to you know just whether you're dead or physically impaired, like the loss of a limb or something like that. And in high-income countries, I think of quality-adjusted life years. So, I think that I'm a quality person myself more than a dolly person. I think it's a, I think even poor people should be thinking of having a good quality of life. I mean, I think it's we should shoot a little higher than just not being dead, you know, or not being able to walk or something. But I think the metrics are fairly well known. You have these problems now with pricing of products, which are people, I think, are obsessed with the idea that you have hair loss remedies or you have erectile dysfunction products. Actually, Viagra was considered one of the better medical inventions in the last period of time because it actually worked, I mean, as opposed to a lot of drugs. I mean, it's a fairly impressive performance in terms of the product. And it's been rated, you know, on objective medical grounds, and it actually, I think, does treat a real medical condition for some people. Obviously, it's used by a lot of people that would have probably be fine without it. But it's a tiny fraction of new drug approvals products like that. If you actually go back and look at new drug approvals in the FDA thing, and you should just read them. And they're pretty serious medical conditions. People register products for it, and they're not as famous as Viagra, but they're more common. And so, you know, you have to avoid the temptation to think that there's nothing but drugs like baldness drugs registered for drugs. I don't think it's really true. The other thing is what people used to call lifestyle drugs weren't even drugs like that. They were drugs like diabetes and heart disease and lung cancer because they said you can avoid these products if you have a better diet or if you have more exercise. So the original term lifestyle diseases were things related to an unhealthy lifestyle. And sort of the story behind it was maybe instead of investing in drugs, maybe we should just get people to have better diet and exercise more, things like that. Or why should we pay for healthcare for people who brought it on by themselves to their unhealthy lifestyle? Nowadays, I think people have reassociated completely lifestyle drugs around Viagra. And I think it sort of misses the point in a way, which is to say that there are very serious medical conditions a lot of people have that are often could have been prevented if they would have led a different lifestyle, but they didn't, you know. And so diabetes is almost a death sentence in Africa because the treatment options are so limited. And it's a very difficult disease here. And I don't think society wants people with diseases like that to go without treatment. I think we want to find ways to treat them. But the short answer to your question would be qualies and dollies are the leading candidates for the metrics. And it's, of course, controversial how you do that. But it's an evidence-based thing. And it turns out it's easier to value pharmaceutical inventions than it is most things that you buy in the marketplace in terms of having social entities do it. Like, you know, imagine films or records or things like that. I mean, we're very comfortable with the market doing the valuation of those things, I think, in some ways. But medicines, patients don't pay themselves anyhow in high-income countries for drugs. They're usually paid for by insurance companies or employers. And even if there are drugs like AIDS, it's donors which are paying for developing country purchases of AIDS drugs often. So I think the fact that people are already implicitly valuing the price of drugs means they can explicitly value the price for a drug.
But do you think that really would get rid of marketing completely? Because maybe when the drug shipping strategy to say, hey, if you use this drug, the quality of life is really, really high. That kind of, you know, makes it seem like their drug is better so that they can get a bigger.
Let me take one more before you start. And Deepa, I'll just take whatever questions are remaining before Jamie answers.
It's my understanding that type 3 diseases, a lot of the disease burden has to do not solely with innovation, but with poor diagnosis and treatment. And I was just wondering that if you envision with this global treaty, whether countries can receive credits for things like helping to find stronger health infrastructures in developing countries and those countries.
Any more?
On the marketing thing first, I think it would probably not a bad thing to have some marketing of products. I mean, that's partly how people learn about availabilities of treatment and doctors get educated and things like that. What would be different, though, is that the rewards would be done by experts looking at evidence. So you could encourage people to use products. But like take for example, Vioxx, for example. Vioxx was marketed very aggressively by Merck way beyond the people that probably needed the product, the people that were, you know, were basically not responding well to other or had adverse reactions to aspirin or things like that. They had a particular reason. I mean, there's a certain population for COX-2 inhibitors that really probably where the benefits probably outweighed the risk, but they just marketed to everyone regardless. In the course of evaluating the COX-2 inhibitors, I think that they probably wouldn't have got very much for extending treatment beyond people to which other well-known alternatives would have done the job. And so it would have been less profitable to invest in marketing the product. You could market, encourage people to use your product, but if they didn't need it, if it was the same as an existing product, you wouldn't get paid for it. So why spend a lot of money to get people to use your Lipitor clone if it's really no better than Lipitor? What you'd have to do is to find a better argument as to why somebody should take it and market it to those people. So I think that you wouldn't want to eliminate marketing, but you want to eliminate the economic incentive for marketing sort of incentives that are not efficient or not medically don't make sense medically. And your question is on could you extend the sort of medical R&D treaty a sort of magic way that everybody gets money, you know, falling out of the sky, and can you apply it to, you know, healthcare delivery systems or other kinds of problems like that? I mean, I don't think it's a good model for that per se. I think that it works particularly good for research and development on things that can be copied in the context of where the fruits of the R&D can be treated as a public good, which is what we're really talking about. And it's about getting people to pay for public goods. If you have things that are not inherently goods or services that can't be copied, like a physician's services or a bed or a space in a hospital, it's just a different problem. And so I think it's special to the fact that you're talking about the creation of knowledge goods. You could talk about extending it beyond medicines to looking at research on healthcare delivery systems or medical devices or lots of other kinds of issues. I mean, our own tendency is to be careful about how broad you define it, because we think we're already pretty ambitious, and it's hard. A lot of little details come up as you know when you're trying to actually make something actually, you know, happen in real life. So then, you know, we want it to be big enough to be worth doing, but not so big that we'd get, you know, it takes 100 years to figure out the details. So I think that, you know, we sort of focused it more narrowly than the broader reform of the entire healthcare system.
Great. So thank you very much. So Jamie's organization is Knowledge Ecology International, which is on the cover of the paper. I will post this paper on our Blackboard site in case anybody didn't get a copy coming around. He's also starting a open source online journal, which will be available in June-ish. And if you're interested in IP health issues going forward, there's a list called IP Health, which you can subscribe to off of the KEI website or the CP Tech website, which I think still exists, right? Yep. And I can give you the address if you need more information. But thank you very much, and thank you all for being in my class all year.
Thank you.